When I look back over my life, I don't see everything in sequence. I recall moments, sensations. My memories are rarely linked chronologically or even logically. Sometimes they're brought to the surface by the sight of an old photograph, the sound of an old song, or, as once was the case, the smell of tear gas. Welcome. Hello. Happy Valentine's Day. Merry Christmas. Whatever holiday is nearest to this, as you hear it. My name is Christian Overfield.
And I am Martha Guzman, and we are the hosts of the Rockstar Autobiography Podcast.
Join us every 2 weeks, sometimes four, six, as we review autobiographies by the greatest and most famous musicians in history. What I just read to you was a portion of Robbie Krieger's autobiography called Set the Night on Fire. Robbie Krieger was the guitarist and one of the principal songwriters for the band The Doors. A very famous band. It is, I think, a fairly big one, Martha.
Yes.
Yeah, it's new territory too. It's like, you know, in our travels, you know, sometimes there's certain areas of music, you know, we've covered more than once. We're kind of like specialists at this point in it. And certain areas on the map we had yet to get to, and this was a good one to, you know, to really, we're always rounding ourselves out, Martha. Always, you know, just showing who we are. We do it all, and we did it with The Doors.
Yes.
This was my pick.
It was.
It was. It is. So if you don't mind, I'm going to go first and take that.
Of course. Please.
Yeah. So
by all means.
how we know The Doors, how connected we are or aren't to the music. I remember getting into them a little bit in high school before the movie came out by a year. There was a period of time where all my friends and I, we got into a little bit, you know, of the Rolling Stones and The Doors. And, you know, that for people today growing up, they romanticized the 80s. We've talked about that. Well, you and I grew up, there was about romanticizing our past. And the past to us was the 50s, the 60s. Not so much the 70s. That wasn't, because we're too close to that. But the 50s and the 60s, and particularly there was a time during the 80s when the 60s were sold to us as like the coolest thing ever, man.
Yes.
And you just had to be there, man, for the flower power. And so I don't know why, if that's why, I'm sure it is a little bit why I got into The Doors. Whom I did like. I think most people had that it was a double CD greatest hits of super famous manager Jim Morrison.
Yes,
did you have that too?
I still do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did wind up liking all of the songs on it. A lot of which were different in musical style than what I was listening to. A lot of them were bluesy, like Roadhouse Blues and Show Me the Way to the...
Yes, I did like all of it.
I no matter how far afield it got from what my core was, I did like it all. I saw Robbie Krieger perform once, Martha. I don't know if you know that.
No, I did not
know
that.
Yes, it was in the early 90s, and he put on a free show in downtown L.A., and there were only, about 250, 300 people.
Where in downtown?
It was out in the street. They had cornered off a tiny little portion of downtown LA just for him to play in the middle of the street. It was super great. He played, in my entire life, I've never seen a guitarist as accomplished ever. He looked like he was, I've just never seen anything like it before. It was a whole new level of musicianship that it was overwhelming. And he had a bassist, kind of like, as he describes Ray Manzarek, the guy was also sort of like a musical savant. The guy who played bass with him, he played the bass with his feet. So he'd built some crazy bass contraption that he could play with his feet so he could play the piano with his hands.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, talk about spinning different plates. I mean, that's like 25 plates over here and then also spinning 18 toasters. The level of musicianship was just crazy. And it kind of speaks to how, you know, back then people, and they just could play their instruments, unlike today where that's just not necessary. But it was really cool. I thought then what he says about himself is that he really did have the worst hair in rock and roll history. And he said something in the book that spoke to why I picked this book, and I felt kind of guilty. He says a lot of fans he gets the impression a lot of them are eager to want his autograph right now, and because they're worried he's going to die soon. And I will frankly admit that that's one of the reasons I'd said to Martha, we got to read this sooner rather than later, because Martha and I have a rule. If, you know, if the person passes away, we just can't touch it. So, yeah, there's that. I have a book on the guitar, like how to play the Doors. And I used to try to play the solo to Light My Fire.
Huh.
And I could only play little pieces of it. I didn't know how to teach myself back then. Now I could probably do it. But so there's that. And yeah, I really don't have a whole lot more, except that I was sort of at this point in my life, I think a lot of people are turned off by the image of the Doors, for better or worse, that has been cemented around them, like the narrative that has established itself around this band. And we learned that it's quite different than how the band really was, which was really a great education. And I was so glad I read the book for that purpose.
Yes.
But apart from having read the book, I was just sick of the Doors. I'm sick of Jim Morrison. I'm sick of people going to his graves. You know, everybody in their 20s thinks it's cool. And if you go down to the Venice Boardwalk, Martha, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to see those stalls of like knockoff shirts, and you're going to see the one of Bob Marley smoking a spliff, and then you're going to see the one of Jim Morrison.
Right.
You know, it's like he's that thing you get at a flea market now. And that's how I think of the Doors. And so for that reason, I just avoid their music. It's like the odor of their perfume is, it's like patchouli so strong that I can't, it just, so anyway, that's my impression. I will tell you, if I may, yes. what I thought of the book.
Yes.
I absolutely loved it. It was just, the smoothest, easiest reading. Like, it went down wonderfully. He seemed very mature and thoughtful and dry humored and smart. Very bright guy. He had a Johnny Marr-esque vibe about how he told his story. He just seemed totally unflappable throughout the book. And I really appreciated the dry humor and the way he told the story. The way he talked about his foibles and flaws, and was always very humorous. I laughed out loud several times, especially towards the end. And I just thought it was excellent. I guess the only... But this is, you know, it's like it's going to become a subject of our discussion. It's on the cover of the book. It's him and Jim Morrison. It's like all of these guys can't have their own identity apart from this man. They feel the need to tell you, hey, I knew Jim. You know, my value is there. It's through the fact that I knew Jim Morrison. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's, I'm not passing judgment, but it gets weird. It's like, just tell me your story. You don't have to tell me Jim's. But I loved it. I read it quickly, very quickly. And I enjoyed it from start to finish. I highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. Martha, I'm passing the hot potato of analysis and musical theory to you now. With your expert eyes and ears, what did you think of the concoction?
You know, let me tell you a little bit about my relationship with the Doors.
Yes.
I actually... the Doors album, the first one, my dad, growing up, my dad played that quite a bit. So, and even as a little kid, I liked it. I liked the music. And I always thought of it as being cool. And I'll be honest with you, Christian, I think that in terms of, you know, the 60s, right? Sort of the Stones and the Beatles,
right,
and the Doors. I think that if I would have been alive in the 60s, the Doors probably would have been my band.
Yeah.
I just like that, their flavor. And I've always gravitated to rock music that has a little bit of a psychedelic edge to it. And obviously the Doors fit that bill. And I've always... I do like the music, you know, and in terms of the book, I didn't like it.
Ooh, Martha's coming out with some knives ready. Okay, let's go.
I didn't like the book. I felt that this could have been titled differently, in the sense that it could have been titled
Reflections.
Jim Morrison, according to Robbie Krieger. I felt that this book was primarily about Jim, and Robbie was after Jim. I didn't really feel that I got to know much about him. There was something about it that, and I agree, I think it was sort of a quick read, but I have to be really honest with you. Through the second half of the book, I hate to admit this, I was just kind of scanning through the pages and trying to get through it as quickly as possible because I was just not into it. I was not into it. And I agree with you. I think he was very thoughtful. Hmm. I was glad that I read it because he was able to share stories that I think have become or stories about the band of the way things really happened, which we can get into in a little bit. But overall, I felt that this was a biography of Jim Morrison because so much of it was based on him. And of course, you know, he was such a big figure, Jim Morrison, right? And he continues to be so. But this is a memoir. And
it's supposed to be his. Yeah,
it's supposed to be his. And I understand when there is someone as big of a personality as Jim Morrison, how you're going to want to talk about it, which of course you are. That was a big part of your life. It's part of the reason that you're even writing this book because you were in the Doors and you were part of this man's life. So of course it makes all the sense in the world, to include the stories about Jim and to include all of that. But I felt that it relied too heavily on that and not so much on him. And, you know, he talks about in the book how Jim Morrison essentially overshadowed them, right? And he enjoyed that when he was in the band, the fact that it was Jim who was the front man and the rest of them in their own way, or at least him in particular, he felt he could kind of hide and just play guitar. And I felt that Jim overshadowed him in his own book.
That's a great way of putting it.
You know, I think he continues to overshadow him. He continued to overshadow him throughout the book because it was always about Jim. And frankly, I felt that because there was so little, I felt that he was really sharing about himself. I mean, yes, he talks about his life and he talks about his marriage and certain other things, but I never really felt that I got to know him. I never really felt that he allowed us to form an opinion of him on his own, aside from the band and aside from Jim. So I didn't really like the book as a memoir. I liked it as an educational book on the Doors. Mm-hmm. I liked it as a book about Jim Morrison because there were things about him that I didn't know that he shed light on. But as a memoir about him, I didn't particularly care for it.
Gotcha. Well, you heard it here first, folks. she didn't care for it. There's another connection I had to it that really, I think, may have colored it for me. He talks, and it's very unusual, although it's a little bit like Lenny Kravitz. It's very upfront that he's had a very privileged upbringing.
Yes.
A very steady, affluent, which was surprising. And his parents are very supportive. But what really struck a chord with me, Martha, is he grew up, as he discusses, in the Pacific Palisades. Yes. And he discusses the creation of Palisades High School. Okay.
Yes.
The creation of it. And he was there as a... My dad was the first graduating class of Pali High.
Oh, wow.
So he and my dad must have bumped into it, must have actually coexisted. And so to read about the Palisades during that time in uni high, because my dad used to talk to me about these things all the time.
Right.
And so here I'm reading about somebody who came from the exact environment.
Yes.
That he did. And so that was really extra fascinating for me to read about somebody else who came from the same high school at the exact same moment in time, whose life, of course, went in a different trajectory. But that was really interesting. I really feel like I got a sense of him. But, you know, like I said, I do agree that I don't know why these people feel the need to make themselves, as you put it, second in their own lives to Jim Morrison.
Yes.
By the same token, I did, you know, you and I have come across again and again this concept of the lead singer and who that is and what that is in a band and how, and if nothing, I think, makes the case more for how important and critical and indispensable that ingredient is, because when without Jim Morrison, for better or worse, there is no Doors, and we see what happens when there is no Jim Morrison. Right. We read about the subsequent efforts where they try to, it really is lightning in a bottle if you get all those ingredients right. And when you take out that elusive, that really rare element of that lead singer, who unfortunately, he was on par with Morrissey in terms of his, and again, you know what, what's funny, Martha? We're already talking about Jim Morrison.
Exactly.
I know. Exactly. And it's frustrating. Okay, so I'm going to force myself to stick to Robbie, okay?
But it's hard to. Because he talks about Jim so much. That's my point, Christian.
I know.
That was my point.
It's a valid criticism.
This book, as I was reading it, I kept thinking, okay, when am I going to get to the parts about you? When is it going to be more about you? Listen, I want to hear these stories. I want to learn about these stories about Jim Morrison, you know, because he's got an insight that nobody else has, right? He was there with him. But this is his memoir. This is not a biography about Jim. Those have already been written. I don't want to hear about Jim Morrison. I want to hear about you. And then tell me about Jim once I've gotten to know about you, because then that gives me a chance to see how you coexisted with this man, why you reacted the way you did towards him, because I've already learned a little bit more about who you were as a man.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But and so it's going to be difficult. I think it's going to be very difficult to talk about this book without mentioning Jim Morrison, because every other sentence was about Jim.
Jim. I think there's an anecdote he tells that kind of metaphorically or is representative of their roles and priorities in terms of the narrative of the story, which only in the 60s does this happen, by the way. He tells us about how he meets his wife
together
forever.
Oh, my gosh.
And if that doesn't tell you the pecking order of the band and the way in which he approaches telling his own story. So he tells you how he meets his wife, and the story begins with Jim Morrison. And Jim, he's already got like 18 girlfriends. And Lynn, that's her name, that's who becomes Robbie's wife, becomes one more of Jim's, you know, weekend girlfriends. And I get the impression a lot of them think they're the only one. And then Lynn freaks out or is mad when she finds out that Jim Morrison, believe it or not, surprise, surprise, has more than one girlfriend. They split up to the extent that can happen in the 60s. Okay. They split up. And then Robbie tells the reader, that's when I swooped in. And to me, that was such a, I don't know that you realize, it sounded so self-emasculating.
Yes.
That you're proud that you swept in after basically
the leftovers.
You got the leftovers. You let Jim have first dibs on what he wants and you settle for the leftovers.
Yes.
And I thought there was something so degrading about that description. I remember laughing and going, oh, okay.
Me too.
It's going to be hard to get on board this romance of yours already knowing that it's born in this way. And so in a sense, that approach or life attitude permeates his story and telling of it, is that he is second to his own story.
Yes.
Like he doesn't stop believing that even as he tells us his life story.
Yes, that's my point, Christian. He always comes second. He came second in his merit, in his relationship with Lynn. He comes in second in his own memoir because, frankly, the stories about Jim Morrison were far more interesting than the ones he told us about him.
But see, I disagree.
I felt that. And I think in part I felt that because it was always his story almost came as an afterthought. And essentially every story that he tells, whether it be about himself or something that happened with the Doors, it's always within the context of, oh, this happened with Jim, blah, blah, blah. And then this happened. Oh, this happened with Jim. Oh, and then this happened. It should be the other way around. It should be, this is my story. This is what I did. Oh, and Jim playing a secondary role in his story. But it's not. It's Jim overshadowing his life. And so,
yeah.
And you know,
it is.
I mean, it's like,
he did.
This should have been.
Yeah. You want to tell the guy to stand up for yourself, particularly because you're at a minimum of 50% songwriter here. I mean, this guy,
he makes a point of telling us repeatedly, I wrote, you know, Light My Fire.
We've read books where these people who barely, like the John Oates syndrome, where, hey, I wrote like a sentence of the novel and let me tell you all about it. Right.
Yes.
I thought, so Robbie Krieger didn't have that attitude. And I think that the reason I feel like I got to know him is he describes himself as like the mellowest guy there is. And when he does drugs, he apparently other people don't like it because they're like, you're already mellow enough. You can't, if you get it mellower, you're just going to dissolve. And that's kind of how he fits in the band with the Doors. You can't imagine another Jim Morrison getting along with Jim Morrison.
Oh God, no. Can you imagine?
That's why I got a Johnny Marr vibe from him, because he's so easygoing all the time. He just lets people be a-holes left and right, up and down, and he never gets upset about it. He never gets his pride irked. He never just says, I've had enough. He just sort of laughs it off. And
you know what,
doesn't
though?
Seem...
What? You know what, though? I don't think that Johnny Marr is quite that mellow. I think Johnny Marr is mellow, but I think he's got a little bit of you know... spice to him. I think that he probably isn't. I don't gather just from what we've read about him, his book, and just having
you and I have met him.
Yeah, we know him, having seen him. I don't think that he's one to just kind of go with the flow if he doesn't think that something is
okay. Well, he left the band. That's what
exactly.
He did.
Exactly. He was like, I'm done.
Just out of the blue, divorce. But he put up with it for a long time without complaining. No, I'm with you. Robbie Krieger takes it to a whole other level. he's just unflappable. You know what? To if we can get to like the best example of that. And I was laughing out loud, Martha, when he was talking about his Doors, the lawsuit.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
I thought that was just wonderful. I really, you know, Martha... we're going to have to just take this moment live in front of our fans and say, you and I are going to end up suing each other.
Oh my gosh, It's okay.
I want to be like he and... So Robbie says that even when he was suing or getting sued by John Densmore, they would still chat in the hallways of the courtroom. And I want to have that kind of lawsuit.
Oh, we're still friends?
our lawyer is going to say the nastiest things about Martha, this is the diva and whatever. I was emotionally abusive to you, whatever they say. But, you know, we're going to meet in the hallway and say, this is part of the narrative. This is how that just means this is our story. We've made it.
We'll be outside laughing and be like, can you believe this shit? Can you believe we're here?
I know.
Can you believe this? We're a real rockstar cliche.
Yeah, we really did it, Martha. We really did it. We found our own way.
Okay, now let's go back inside the courtroom and fight.
So the Doors, you know, his whole life is in relation to this. And, you know, and it should be. I understand, Martha, what you mean, because it's totally. And, you know, really quick, I got to admit, I knew Ray Manzarek had died. I thought John Densmore had died, too, for some reason.
No, he's still alive and kicking.
I went to go because I really liked this book, Martha. Because it was so, again, not, it was just, it went down so smooth while I also got, I think, a great education in the story of the Doors. So
I loved, okay, I will say this.
Hold on really quick. Don't lose your thought. I went to go look at John Densmore's book because he's written one. And on the cover, it's not a picture of John Densmore. It's him standing behind Jim, not in front of him, behind Jim Morrison. You know what, Martha? If we release a shirt or a poster of us, it should be the two of us standing behind Jim Morrison, trying to peek above his shoulders. or hiding under his arms. You know that one image? Bending down, trying to see past him.
One of us on each side of him. Yeah. Yeah. We'll Photoshop ourselves.
Oh man. Okay, so tell me, what was your
what I was gonna say is that that's the reason that I felt the way that I did about this book, because it's always It was just about him. And I will say this, I did appreciate what I liked about it is that I learned so much about the Doors that I didn't know before. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, this is really cool. I'm learning so much about Jim's official.
Jim Morrison.
I'm so much about
it's a better
Jim.
It's a better biography of Jim Morrison than Jim Morrison's own.
I was like, this is the best. Robbie is really like the best biographer of Jim Morrison.
Yeah. Yeah. If you add what John Densmore said and Ray Manzarek.
Yeah, this is like the best biography ever.
You know what? If somebody asks me what to read, what biography to read about Jim Morrison, I go, you got to pick up Robbie Krieger's. It's great.
It's amazing. You're going to love it. That's what I will say this. That is what kept me reading the book. I think that if it had.
Maybe I'll mention Jim. Yeah, like,
maybe, let's see what other crazy stories is going to come up about Jim.
There should be a drinking game every time he mentions
Jim. Oh, my God. I would have been as drunk as Jim.
Oh, yeah.
I would have been as drunk as Jim.
Jim Morrison couldn't have kept up. Jim Morrison himself would have said, I can't do this.
He would have been like, stop.
No way.
Stop naming
crazy.
Me. I'm so drunk. I can't have another bottle of whiskey.
Oh, yeah. In love with me much? Jeez.
Oh, my goodness.
Again, he was such a mellow guy and easygoing.
And I appreciated the tone of his. I will say this. I did appreciate the tone of the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's very digestible. It's very... Mm-hmm. He is.
There's no anger in it.
There's no anger.
Nothing.
He's very thoughtful. And all I kept thinking was, you know, maybe the meditation really has worked for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was, he does. I will say this. He seems like a very nice man. That's the impression mm-hmm. I got.
He does. I would like him at my table.
Yeah.
I feel like he'd be easygoing.
Yeah,
he'd have some dry humor.
Yeah. He does mm-hmm. seem like, you know, he's a nice, easygoing guy.
Well, he, as an example of his mellowness, which was surprising, he says just before Jim Morrison dies, he gives to Robbie Krieger and I guess the band like a chapbook of handwritten poems or lyrics.
Yes.
And it's signed to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's up front that he thinks he's lost it or it might be somewhere in storage. And he just doesn't seem like put out by it. Like it could be there. It might not be. And the same thing about he describes as the first guitar he ever bought as a result of seeing Chuck Berry yes. perform at Santa Monica, I think the Civic Center.
Correct.
And I mean, this guitar is used on the first Doors album. It's used in his audition to get in the Doors and it's stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And he just doesn't seem upset or angry or remorseful. He's just like, hey, it is what it is. And somebody's got it and whatever. He brings that at all. Okay, you wanted to say something.
No, that's exactly what I wanted to say. That he seems so unfazed by everything,
mm-hmm.
and he's just so chill. And all I kept thinking was, this is the point that I want to reach with my meditation practice, where nothing bothers
yeah,
me.
Yeah, you want to reach
this
that level.
This is the level I want to reach because I'm not quite there yet. If I had mm-hmm. these lyric, I mean, it's you know, there's somewhere, and he says, yeah, there's somewhere in storage, I'm sure. I don't know,
right.
There's somewhere. And it's like, oh my God.
He thinks.
He's not even sure about it. He's like, I think it might be somewhere in storage. And the thing with the guitar, it's the same. But you know what? There is some, I also understood that though, when he says the music is there, that guitar served its purpose. And I was like, you know what?
Yeah.
You know what, Robbie? Mm-hmm. I get it. I totally get it. It served its purpose. And whether or not you physically have this guitar, it did what it was supposed to do. And it wrote and it played amazing music that is now mm-hmm. out in the universe. So like, I got it.
Right.
You know, I got it. But he does seem like a very nice, chill, mellow man.
Mm-hmm.
I did.
He's easy going about the song credits.
He is.
He's when he talks about that lawsuit, which is, I couldn't believe they lost. I mean, I would have just had ulcers left and right realizing.
Well, you need to meditate. Like,
I will.
Robbie.
So what happens is, I've been told I'm a very tense person, actually.
That you're a very tense person?
Robbie. Yeah, I do not have Robbie's ability to just let it go. But anyway, So after he and Ray Manzarek, you get a sense, are much closer than they are to John. But they all seem to like one another kind of the same, but yes. He and Ray just get along better.
Yes.
So he and Ray, and I'm sure some of our listeners know this, because I do remember the New Doors, you know, started playing with Ray Manzarek and Robbie, yes, Krieger and the dude from The Cult. And I remember that. And so right away, what happens is lawsuits begin, because they ask John Densmore, hey, is it cool? They invite him on the tour. They're like, hey, let's all do this, the three of us, and we'll just get a new lead singer, and we'll just play Doors songs. And John Densmore is difficult and says, no, I don't want to do it. But he does say, fine, go be the Doors. So they go touring, and apparently they make a ton of money, like a surprising amount of money on this
tour. They tour all around the world.
You know what? I guess saying that out loud right now, Martha, I realized that's exactly why John Densmore changes his mind, essentially, and sues them and says, you can't use the name The Doors.
Because he's upset that they're making a ton of money and he's not part of it.
Yeah. And so he's like, you got to call yourself something else. And so Ray, I thought he was really funny, Martha. He tells he says it was a lawsuit about font size, because people kept making posters, and no matter what he told these people to call, you know, we're called the New Doors or the Doors this, they would always just put the Doors in huge font. And he said, it's like, even if we called ourselves two guys who are absolutely not the Doors, guess what the poster would look like? And it was super funny. And he describes the lawsuit, and these lawsuits are so interesting to read about when the lawyers get involved, and how they're, even though they seem to have an unlosable hand, their lawyers just kind of are overly aggressive and hostile and just play their cards wrong. So they win the initial lawsuit until the judge, you know what? My blood was boiling for him. He didn't seem to care at all. So they've won the lawsuit, but the judge just unilaterally decides, I don't like the jury's verdict, I'm going to come up with a new one. And he awards to John Densmore, the drummer who hasn't been on this tour at all, 50%. When I read that, Martha,
did you throw your book across the room?
I did. I couldn't believe, I felt like, man, these drummers, Martha, it's these drummers, you got to watch out for these drummers, man. You think that they're not scheming, but man, they'll swoop in and take what's theirs and more.
Well, you know, I've always,
Mike Joyce and John Densmore now, two drummers that just took.
I've always said that really it's the drums that carry tunes. I don't know. I feel strongly about that. I think that the drums really. I think that I think you're right. I think that a lot of the time what ends up happening in these court cases, and especially with band members and you know, and all that, is that I think in this instance, I think that you're right, Christian. I think that it was partly seeing that they were being so successful and then thinking, well, wait a minute here.
Yeah.
You know, what's going on? Yeah. And I think that that was also probably the reason that he gave the blessing, right? I think that part of the reason for that was because he probably thought, well, how successful can this really... Exactly. He misjudged the fact that it would be as successful as it was. Because, right. I mean, this isn't just one off gig or two. I mean, they are touring the world and they're filling, you know, stadiums and places up with fans just excited to hear these songs live. And, you know, I imagine also, Christian, that it wasn't just sort of a nostalgia for people who grew up in the 60s. I imagine that it was also perhaps younger people who come into the Doors and they want to hear these songs live and they didn't get a chance to. And so you have a variety of people excited to finally be able to see part of the Doors, even if Jim is no longer there.
Yes, correct. They probably just had a massive picture of his face up the whole time.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, John Densmore sounds horrible, because not only did he sue them for no good reason that I could see, assuming, of course, Robbie Krieger's account is correct, and then win. Prior to that, the same guy who was like, hey, no, man, I'm protecting the Doors' artistic memory, and Jim Morrison wouldn't want us to sell out. So Ray Manzarek and the remaining Doors members are offered $15 million. And this, I tell you, this must have been like 20 years ago, too, Martha.
Right.
$15 million for you. I think it's Chrysler or Buick. Want to use, is it Break On Through? I think it's Break On Through. Yeah. And Ray Manzer kind of needs the money because he's just not, I guess, been smart with his financial choices. And John Densmore blocks that. And, oh my God, $15 million? And earlier, John Densmore was totally fine. I think we read using the, you know, he's, when he wants to sell out, it's fine. But when he gets on his artistic high horse,
isn't that the way it always is? That's the way it always is. Oh, man.
I couldn't. And Robbie Krieger is like, he's like, oh, whatever. Okay. It's the one time he put something he italicized, though. He's like, $15 million. And he didn't get that. They didn't get that cash because John Densmore, not only did they not get the $15 million, John Densmore got their money.
Would you sell out, Christian, for $15
million? Yes.
Yes, so would I.
Oh, man. I would.
You
want me to say or do, I will do it.
I feel that you can still have artistic integrity. Listen to this. Listen. No, I think that you can still, if your output is so good, that right there is the artistic value that you've brought.
I see.
That's what I mean. Yeah. I think it's okay to sell it to the highest bidder. Why not? Why not?
Well, yeah, we were approached by Yogurtland. They made us a strong offer, but we were like passionate then. We're like, no,
yeah, but
we're not going to take lifetime free yogurt under any circumstances.
I've changed my mind since then, though, haven't you?
Yeah. You're like, you know what? That would have been pretty cool.
That would have been pretty cool to just walk into any Yogurtland and get free yogurt for life.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, my nephews would have appreciated it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Goodness.
Well, a little bit. So he, just brief, he grows up in the affluent Palisades, an awesome upbringing. The Doors kind of use and rely upon him when they need an attorney, when they need money for a bass guitar. They know that Robbie's like comes from an intact, wholesome family. And that family does deliver. They get the attorney when Jim Morrison needs it. They get the bass for Ray Manzarek when they need it.
The dad lends them money.
The family support. He's going to UC. My dad went to UCLA too, Martha. Oh, right? Robbie went to UCLA. Yeah, the whole thing continued. Maybe my dad is.
Ray maybe. Maybe your dad knew him.
Yeah. I did enjoy, like you said, for the education, he just totally, it was crazy to read that. The entire movie of The Doors was basically just created from scratch. All of it. Yes. I mean, I vividly remember that scene in The Doors when she lives on Love Street and there's Meg Ryan, Val Kilmer's all chatting her up and, you know, in Venice.
Yes.
That never happened.
Yes.
Every single scene in the movie never happened. And it really, and again, Robbie Krieger is so like, whatever, man, it's just a movie. You got to make some choices. You know, while Ray Manzarek is pissed. And I was on his side, and I guess Ray Manzarek just would not, after he had one meeting with Oliver Stone, and he, I guess, saw the direction the movie was going to go, he was just, and I remember that happening at the time, and thinking, I thought at the time that Ray Manzarek was sour grapes, but now that I realize that Oliver Stone just basically made a musical based on nothing.
He took creative freedom.
Yeah.
Do you remember how huge that movie was when it came out? It was.
Yeah.
It was
a deal.
It was huge. I mean, it was just everywhere. And, you know, I have to say, I think Val Kilmer to this day, I feel like he embodied him. And he talks about that, too. Robbie talks about how he was always in character. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen the documentary, the Val Kilmer documentary?
I have not because I think it'll make me sad.
It's so beautiful.
Really?
I cannot recommend it enough.
Really?
Cannot recommend it enough. Yes, it is really excellent and very heartfelt and wonderful.
Oh, okay. I'll highly recommend it. I feel like it'll make me so sad for his current state. And
it will do. It'll make you sad, but also kind of give you it's also uplifting simultaneously.
It's going to be something that's going to make me cry. I'll watch it. I'm sold. Yes. I'll watch it.
I recommend it.
I recommend it.
More things I like about Robbie.
Tell me what
I love.
Let's just call that episode this. The things Christian
things
likes
I love about Robbie.
Yes.
Okay. There's a portion where he talks about his advice to fledgling bands about paying their dues. And I really enjoyed reading somebody say that. He says, so earn your fans one by... He talks about their first gig, which in theory, anybody's first gig can look like theirs, where if you invite every single family member you've got, all your friends. For one show, it's going to look sold out, but then the second night, it's empty.
Right.
So he says, you've got to earn them one by one. And you said, play to the empty rooms, play to the... And I really enjoyed reading
that. I did too, Christian.
It was... very mature thing to say, and it was anytime like the Brett Anderson things. It's like earn it, like just like hair by hair, inch by inch, fan by fan.
Yes,
that's and you know what I tell you, the one thing global lesson I have taken from these stories, which has actually been very inspiring, is that is your story, not your success if and when it comes. It's the struggle.
It's the struggle. That's the beauty.
That is your beauty.
That even if it doesn't feel like it at the time.
Yeah.
But I think that that translates. Oh, I love when we start getting philosophical, Christian, because that really.
We're deep people.
What can we say? Because that truly translates into everything in life and into every aspect of life. It's in those moments when you're struggling, you know, like I think about, you know, think about your career, think about things in your life that really matter. And it's in the struggle, even though it doesn't feel good in the moment, even though it doesn't feel like it's ever gonna, you're ever gonna get out of it. There is always in that struggle, that's where the growth is gonna happen. And I know that so many times when we are in it, it just feels as though you are done with growth and that you are done, you know, in terms of you feel like you are owed this now because you've already paid your dues, or you feel that you have, and God, where is the reward, right? But sometimes the longer the struggle, the sweeter the reward is. And I think that that is something that is true in every aspect of someone's life. When you finally get that thing, whatever that thing is that we are after, after a long time of struggle, the sweetness of it and the sweetness of finally getting it is going to be valued so much more. And what he says is that, you know, so to anyone listening who might be an aspiring musician, he talks about...
aspiring anything.
Yes, anything. Yeah. But obviously, you know, in this sense with bands and music, you know, he talks about if you're on stage and you are playing to an empty room, it's okay, because that's when you're going to start getting better. It's take it as practice. Don't look at it as, you know, something negative, but rather something positive, because in playing so many times, you're going to perfect what you are playing. And so I appreciated that too, because he does say that, you know, you've got to earn them. And, you know, that also then also made me think about, for instance, when I go to a show, right? And I go to a show of a band that I like, especially a band that I might be really, really super fanatical about. And how I never understand, Christian, when people are just standing there too cool for school, watching a band that they love, right? And they're just stand there and just kind of be calm and collected. And that's not the kind of audience member that I am. And so I can never understand how you cannot give off more energy to a band that has given you so much joy. And I feel like that's the reward for them. You know, your enthusiasm, you cheering, you screaming, you going crazy, that is the payoff for the bands that you see. Hard-earned.
If you're there.
Yeah, if you're there. Yeah, they've earned it. They've earned your hard-earned cash that you are giving them to perform for you. Why were you just stand there and act so cool and calm? Like, come on, show them some love, you know? And so I appreciated that part of his book where he talks about that too.
Yeah, I did very much. Other things I liked about Robbie. I like that he talks about, you know, the Doors of reception. That's where Jim Morrison got the title, Doors. And Robbie's like, oh, I read that. And Jim's like, wow, cool, man. And Robbie's like, yeah. And he tells us he just thought it was boring.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yes.
I enjoyed, which was a genuine nugget of rock and roll history, that he says that he and Ray, this is where he meets Ray Manzarek. They meet, not... not Ravi Shankar, but the Maharishi.
Yes, I'm so glad I was going to. I wanted to talk about
the Maharishi.
This. They do
before the Beatles made him famous.
Yes.
I mean, that's ground floor. And I also doubly loved that they were like, you know, they don't tell a story that he's amazing. And of course, Jim Morrison meets him. And even, you know, you'd think based on the movie and the image that you get of the Doors that they'd be like totally into the Maharishi, but they're not. They're just like, I don't get any vibes. It's not working for me. And I just love the notion of the Maharishi starting out in this rich, all white neighborhood of the Pacific Palisades. It's just not the image that's been sold through the narrative of the 60s. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's just it. Exactly. And, you know,
He does a good job of that, Martha. Really, yes. Cracking that mystique apart.
Yes, he does. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed reading about that as well because, you know, the Beatles essentially, you know, made this man. They act like he was a god of some sort. And the reaction that Robbie has towards him is just kind of like, you know, like I meditated and I did all this, but whatever. And yeah, Jim's attitude towards him is like, I'm not feeling the vibe with this guy. You know, it's very, it's interesting. And, you know, I mean, he later on, I remember seeing him on TV when I was a little kid. Like he had there was something on like public access TV or something where he would come on. And, you know, Christian, I've shared this with you and a lot of people who know me know this. I am fascinated by cults. And I always thought of him as somewhat of a cult leader, kind of, you know? And when you start learning more about him, I mean, this guy was really dealing with a lot of people that were wealthy. You know, the guy drove a Rolls Royce. And look, I'm not going to bash on anyone for having nice material possessions. But if you present yourself a certain way and you're enlightened and, you know, it kind of goes against what that is supposed to be, right? Which is not necessarily tying yourself to material possessions and all of these sorts of things. But the Maharishi was the opposite of that. I mean, he was wealthy and he drove around in nice cars and he was around, you know, very wealthy people. And later on, again, started coming out like he was somewhat of a cult leader and people had a lot of negative things to say about him. And so I love the fact that they were all unimpressed by him. They thought it was cool. They were all into the enlightenment thing because it was the 60s, you know? So of course they were into that and they all wanted to experience it. And he talks about how he started meditating at that time. But even when he first started, he talks about how like he didn't really feel anything. And he was constantly thinking, wait, I'm not feeling any different. Nothing's happening for me. And so
at one point, Ray Manzarek's like, did you feel that? He's like,
Yeah, no, I didn't. Like, no, I didn't.
No.
So I think that, you know, I liked how honest he was about all of this stuff. And I think it plays into, you know, the fact that he's such a mellow guy that he's so real and unsuperficial that it's just like he's just giving it to you straight. So I did I appreciated
it. It was straight.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. Oh, you know what? Oh, we would be remiss if we didn't, you know, we do the work for you. We climb, look, to our fans, we go all the way down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and up to tell you the nuggets, so you don't have to.
That's right. Okay? That's right.
We discover, I don't think people know this, I didn't, that were it not for the Doors and Jim Morrison, there's no Iggy Pop.
Yes!
That was huge.
Oh my gosh.
Huge.
Yes. Yes.
Because
that was enormous. That was enormous.
Yeah. I mean, that was like panning for gold and we got a big one.
We did, because how many other books have we read?
Wow.
How many other people
have
talked about Iggy Pop, right?
He's the Elvis David Bowie of punk rock.
Yes, and he's made an appearance in so many of the books we've read. Mm-hmm. And to learn that had it not been for him seeing the Doors at the University of Michigan, there would not maybe have been a Iggy Pop, but tell the story, Christian. Tell the story.
That's it. You just told it. You know what? When I read that story, again, I hope you felt the same way, Martha. I'm always mesmerized by how the story of rock and roll is the story of cause and effect of one person influencing another, who influences another.
Yes.
And it passes itself along. It's a torch that just carries and carries and
it
carries.
It really does.
I really love that part of it.
Me too.
Each person who becomes an idol to somebody else was besotted with somebody else, you know?
And
nothing's changed from the first thing that inspired, like, hey, let's read the John Taylor book. It was when I saw John Taylor acting like such a 13-year-old fan for the Beatles. I'm like, wow, this thing called music, and people, it's just passing on enthusiasms and passions. And I loved when that nugget, the Iggy Pop yes. nugget, was a big one. Huge.
Yes, it really was. Because, and yeah. well, really the story, Christian, is the fact that they have a pretty bad show. I mean, it's yeah. people are rioting and people are, you know, going crazy. And Jim Morrison got criticized for it and people were kind of freaking out. But the one that wasn't freaking out
right.
was Iggy Pop.
Iggy Pop. Yeah, he's like riveted. I found my identity.
Yes. He's yeah. standing there and he's just wowed by Jim Morrison. Mm-hmm. And he thinks he's the coolest. And wow, look mm-hmm. at him just doing whatever the hell he wants and not caring. And so I thought, wow, this is amazing because all of these stories, they're all, I mean, you know,
interconnected.
Yes. Yeah. And you've talked about this before, Christian. You've described it as a tapestry, right? Where there's yeah. all of these different characters from all of these different books that we've read, but somehow they are all interconnected with one
yeah,
another.
It's amazing.
In ways yeah. that you wouldn't even imagine. And that's what makes reading these books so fascinating to me because I feel yeah. like we always end up finding something yeah. out. And I feel that in that sense, this book did its job as...
Yeah, it did. These nexus
yes,
points.
Yes, yes. it did its job in terms of educating us about music
it
history.
It did. Yes. Yeah, it absolutely did that. You know, another thing that... even though Jim is like, hey, by the way, I know a popular guy named Jim Morrison. That's, you know, a valid criticism. He, an educational part is he describes that Jim Morrison, when he was under pressure to perform... couldn't do it, really. Yes. He was like flat and lifeless yes. at the Hollywood Bowl when yes. the cameras were rolling. Anytime people were in the room and looking, he couldn't bring it out. Yes. He was just lifeless. And I mean, he was candid about that. I really enjoyed reading that description of the Hollywood Bowl show. And you get a sense of how proficient he and Ray and the drummer were as musicians, that they were always on point. They were always at an A-plus level.
Well, they had to be.
And Jim was like, that was their job, is to constantly be awesome at that thing. And Jim was the Morrissey of the band, who just felt like showing up or not as...
Well, and that's just it. You know, he talks about some of the early shows, right? And how the first, when they first start out... it's all very, you know, they're playing at small venues as most bands. But the second half after the release of the album, he says, changes everything. The first half of 1967, yeah. when their first album comes out, it's all very small town, it feels like. At least that's the impression that I got. That it's all very much yeah. high school, you know, gyms and small clubs and small things. But then as the record starts picking up steam and the songs are coming out and people are learning more about them and seeing and hearing more, it just changes dramatically from the first half of when the album comes out. And so at yeah. this point, they are just kind of in this whirlwind, right? And he talks about how Jim, as the band gets bigger and bigger, Jim's behavior becomes more and more erratic. At least that's how I saw it, right? And
yeah, so, I did too.
And so, they are always the ones that are left literally on stage
cleaning
up the mess.
Yeah.
So they had to be on point. They had to be these professional musicians. They had to pick it up because if not, then there's nothing. There's no music. There's nothing because Jim was drunk half the time or stumbling or yelling at the audience or doing it. And he talks about how at some points it almost felt like people were going to the shows for that. And you know what was really interesting, Christian? As I've said in this show many times, I'm a huge Jesus and Mary Chain fan. And reading about those early shows reminded me of what early Mary Chain shows were described as being, where people were rioting, people were going crazy and like breaking things. And so right. much of what their shows were like at the beginning were like that, you know. And he talks about how with the Doors, it almost became a spectator event where sometimes people yeah. would just go to see like,
this is what we're doing. Yeah. Oh, it's a Doors show. Let's go smash.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, what is Jim going to do this time? And so it was almost as though it wasn't so much for the music. I mean, obviously they were fans and they liked the music, but it was more to see what antics he was going to get up to
yeah.
on that day. And, you know, sometimes they would end up just playing music without Jim. or yeah, Ray, or music without Jin. Or Ray would start singing, or someone would start singing, but eventually they'd walk off stage.
So when the Doors dissolve, he has some fairly funny, dry sentences about how, to the reader about how he's pretty sure that Jim isn't going to come back anymore because he's dead at that point.
Right.
And it was funny. Only he could make these jokes.
Of course.
And I really thought his, how he described his reaction to Jim's death.
Yes.
Was really real and yes. only he could have because he, it was all, so much of it was, he felt relieved. Because, and you do get a sense, I mean, Jim Morrison sounded like not somebody I'd ever want to spend any time with. He sounded like if he's sober, a nice person, but then he just goes into this Jim Morrison thing he does. And I couldn't have tolerated that for 5 seconds, Martha.
No.
None of it was fun or romantic. It was just an egomaniac to me. I just couldn't tolerate that. But, given the description of what it's like to be with this guy who basically, like, if Morrissey were super alcoholic and you know, and that kind of person, since the description of Jim and the experience of living with him and being in a band with him is detailed, you do relate and understand why he says when he discovers that Jim's died, something that, you know, how it happens today in our culture where people are reported as dead when they're not.
Right.
Well, I guess it had happened a few times with Jim Morrison.
Correct.
And so, but this time Jim's not answering the phone. So yes. It becomes real. And he says he's relieved. Something else. I don't think he says the word happy, but it's something along those lines.
Yes.
You get a sense that he had all this, like, it's like living with an abusive partner around whom you have to walk on eggshells and all that, being tense all the time. He finally gets to relax because, well, now the thing's over and he no longer has to worry about managing this human being, somebody else. And so I appreciated that was an insight because only Robbie Krieger could tell you what it's like when Jim Morrison dies. It's become the most, one of the single most famous episodes of rock and roll history.
Correct.
You know, and to read Robbie to say, honestly, this was my reaction, not much sadness.
And I think that, you know, his feelings about it, because he talks about how, you know, his initial reaction is almost relief. And then mm-hmm. he says happiness, too, that mm-hmm. Jim had, he had essentially predicted his death when after Janis Joplin dies. He says, oh, I'll be the third one. Jim says this.
He got what he wanted.
Yeah. And he says, well, I was in a way sort of happy that he got what he wanted. And I think he later says, but then obviously I went through grief. I went through anger. I went mm-hmm. through all of these different feelings. And right. I think for any of us who've been unfortunate enough to lose a friend, I think that you do go through feelings like that. You do go through this range of emotions. When that happens. And I think that the first one oftentimes is shock and disbelief, which he also says that he had after he dies, you know, because there were so many times where, you know, there were stories that he'd passed and it wasn't true. And then it's kind of like, oh, really? Like, oh, it really happened. And so there's a little bit of shock attached mm-hmm. to it. But he does say after that, it's almost relief. And I appreciated that candor because I don't know that anybody else, you know, mm-hmm. I think that Jim Morrison has been elevated to this almost godlike stature. Yeah, and
for
so
sure.
for someone to say, I was kind of glad he died. I mean, that's heavy.
Yeah.
That's
that
heavy.
Bold.
Right. And so, but like you said, I mean, if there's anyone that can say it, it's someone that was that close to him.
Yeah, who's earned the right and had to deal with the guy.
Yes.
Over and over and over. Oh, it's exhausting to read. There's nothing to me romantic about Jim Morrison at all.
There wasn't. There really wasn't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's interesting, right? Because I think a lot of the time, I think especially as lead singers, there's a lot of romanticism around mm-hmm. them because they sing or they say these beautiful words. And so there's a lot of, you know, fantasy mm-hmm. that's attached to that, right? As an audience towards the lead singer. But I think that in this case, I mean, if there was ever a romantic, you know, if he was ever romanticized and someone reads this book, they come away with a different Jim Morrison. And I mean, he does say, though, I will say this. One of the things that he does say is, that when he was not drunk or high, He was a very nice Southern gentleman.
Yeah, I like that. I've read about that before. People like that who, when they meet somebody's parents, are really polite and they have a sense of manners and they demonstrate good character in those moments. You know.
Yes.
And it just all seemed to disappear the second he. I got a sense that ultimately Jim Morrison was an alcoholic more than anything. And I enjoyed reading him eating. He eats three plates of food, and the waitress is like, "You can't do that." He's like, "I'm a millionaire, honey. I can do anything I want." And Robbie says, "It's funny that all these people who, I guess, you know, they're Elvis impersonators, they're people who want to be Jim Morrison. But as he points out, nobody wants to be fat Jim Morrison with the beard. You know, they always just want to be svelte Jim." And he says the only reason Jim Morrison ever was svelte like that with those cheekbones is because that's when he was doing heavy hallucinogenics, which suppresses appetite. And so he's not eating any food. So you're looking at a drugged out weirdo. That's,
well, you know, there was
Jim Morrison likes to eat three plates of food and get fat like the rest of us. That's the real Jim. That's the fifth album. You know, I would have liked that one.
Why I'm laughing?
Why?
I'm laughing because I'm thinking about the 90s. You remember Heroin Chic? When everybody was like the thing, right? And it's sort of like it's the same with, I mean, that's why he had that amazing jawline.
Yeah, he did. You know, that's what Robbie, he says word for word, Robbie says that. He had that amazing jawline.
It was an amazing jawline. I mean, he did. He had an amazing jawline. But, you know, I mean, that can only last so long, unfortunately, for all of us.
So two things I'd be remiss to leave out is that what was a huge surprise, and I think we're never going to read a description quite like this one, was Robbie Krieger apparently becomes a heroin addict. That was out of left field for me. I'm like, oh my gosh, I had absolutely no idea. Why would I? Because he's second in the pecking order. No one cares about Robbie Krieger. You know what I mean? There's no posters of him in the Venice boardwalk with him with his arms spread out with the worst hair in rock and roll, right? But his description of being a heroin addict was actually the only one that was sort of funny, because he just tells it with like, yeah, can you believe I was a heroin addict? And he does all the things. He and his wife go to his kids' like parent day, and his own child is like, please don't come. All I know is something's deeply wrong with you and mommy because you're nodding off all the time. And that's exactly what happens at back to school night, is that his wife just starts totally nodding off.
No, it's not back to school. It's career day or whatever. Yeah.
And Robbie is like jamming in front of the class, high as hell. I thought it was the funniest out of left field because, you know, it's just, you look at Robbie Krieger and you don't see a heroin addict. It's, like it or not, you think of like the lead singer as making heroin romantic, man. And you know what I mean? Like, okay, I'm just chasing the dragon.
Yes.
But to read about Robbie Krieger, the guy who looks like he's an accountant for the Doors, him chasing the dragon, there's just no romance at all.
Hold on.
He describes like using pliers to try to pull out the bugs he sees in his arms. And it's pathetic and funny at the same time. It had none of that grim depression that I'm used to, like Anthony Kiedis's or anybody else's. It just seemed like these suburban weirdos doing heroin. It was great.
The way he tells the story is very matter of fact. He's such a mellow kind of guy that he doesn't over dramatize anything. He's not melodramatic about it. He just is telling you the facts, and he's just kind of laying it out. And he's saying, yeah, you know, my wife and I, we used to go into the bathroom and spend hours there, and we would host parties, and then we would get out of the bathroom and everybody was gone. We spent the whole night just getting high in the bathroom.
Like, how long was he in that bathroom?
I was like, wow.
Can you imagine?
Can you imagine
dinner party, you're waiting for so long, the host never comes out, you're like, well,
I'd be like Jim Morrison, I'd just be stuffing my face like, let's eat.
Yeah, I guess this is nuts.
Let's eat. That
was a good story. Okay,
well, I mean, he did have these interesting stories, but you know what I was gonna say, Christian? Okay, I wonder if, I don't know, because I don't know. I mean, I wonder if he ever felt that having his wife having been with Jim, right?
Right.
I wonder if it ever sort of crossed his mind, like maybe she had settled for less with him. I mean, obviously,
any sane
she did
human
it.
Being would have had those doubts.
You
and
know,
worries.
Like I can't imagine, you know, that your wife is with this guy that so many women wanted right. to be with.
He gets syphilis. He's been through so many women.
I mean, he's been through so many women. He gets syphilis. Jim Morrison gets syphilis. Okay, this was so much information. So apparently Jim Morrison gets, of course, I mean, he probably had every STD ever known to man.
Right.
But he gets syphilis. And
nice.
He's romanticizing his syphilis
yes.
by saying, oh, I want to feel like the poets and the
yeah, Rimbaud,
whatever. Yeah. Yes. I want to be like them who they all had syphilis.
Yes.
And I want to see how insane I can possibly get. So he says, you know, and Robbie tells us that it gets pretty bad to the point where it's really yeah. bad. And they finally convince him or Jim decides to yeah. finally go to the doctor when he is yeah. having so much pain when he urinates.
Yeah, he's not that committed to romance.
He's not that committed.
He wants antibiotics.
Well, he is committed to romance because he's caught syphilis, so he's committed to something. But yeah, but anyhow, but I wonder just how much, like I wonder if even, you know, obviously she made the better choice, right? By getting together with Robbie. He seems like such a
yes. Yes.
But in all of that, I mean, we are humans,
right.
And I cannot imagine that at any point in their relationship, it didn't cross his mind.
Every day right? would have crossed it. If he's normal, if he's not the most mellowest man on the world, who's just indifferent. He was so excited to swoop in for the leftovers. You got a sense he was like a little yapping dog waiting until the relationship was done so he could just get the remnants. It was sad. That was the saddest page of the whole book, inadvertently. All right, part two, we have to tell our readers that this is, again, where the reason I don't like these lead singers is...
Lead singer?
It's
not the lead singer, honey. He's
no, I'm talking about Jim Morrison. It's so... What their decision to be themselves and to take it off the cliff and die, it's so selfish because now the Doors don't have a lead singer. And as the Doors can tell you, you don't have a career anymore with that guy. So Robbie decides to start a new band. And it was a name only the world's cutest killers from Kathy Valentine's has a band name because she tries to start a band after the Go-Go's and she calls it the world's cutest. I remember reading that with you, Martha, and like, oh my God, this is, I'm embarrassed for her.
When I read the name, I'm not
going to
say the name.
Robbie Krieger's, second band. I couldn't believe it.
I thought of you and I thought, oh my God, Christian must have just died when he read this.
It's so, I don't know else to tell. I'll just tell it to you straight if you're listening. After you've been in the Doors and sold out the Hollywood Bowl, this is what occurs to you as a great name for your next band. This is it. The Butts. Just like you think it's spelled. Not like butt and for, you know. No. The two T's. The Butts. And he tries to give you a description to like explain where it came from and why. But it is so embarrassing, Martha, to read that portion. He himself, you know, he doesn't once try to sell it to you as anything but the dumbest, stupidest thing ever.
Yeah.
Down to the record release party.
Where, oh, my gosh.
He
so crass.
Yeah, they hire somebody to run naked through the Chase's or one of those famous Hollywood institutions.
Like a fancy family.
One of those, like the Dresden or Chase's or something. And they hire somebody to run to streak through the restaurant and paint it on their buttocks is the name of the band or something.
The Butts.
This guy was adrift, man. He just was, he just, what an odd dude. And his whole life is, and rightfully so, in relation to one of the paragraphs that he says that most people think we're crazy to ever have thought we could move on as the Doors ever. And you can see why. And he says that they actually had an actual hit as the Doors subsequent to Jim Morrison called The Mosquito. Now, I did that thing, Martha, because, you know, why... people can rely on us. I went to listen to that song, The Mosquito. I think it's it's crap. It's just terrible. It's like, what is it? It's like a novelty song. It sounds like something off of a B-side on Ween's album, you know? It's just, his whole life is just, but.
Adrift.
It's not just adrift. It's in, once he puts the Butts aside, his whole life is pretty much in reaction to being in the doors. Yeah. But to his, I gotta say, I've never been in the door. I've never had in my life a moment where I was in anything that was like the Doors. So me, I didn't hold it against him that the rest of his life was just sort of being in that. And do you know what was weird, Martha? He expresses genuine bewilderment or belief that he thought that the Doors were going to be swallowed up by history. It's just some band. And I thought that was surprising because...
Yes, that was surprising to me too.
Even if you're not a huge Doors fan, Light My Fire, there's some songs where just the musicality of alone, the Hotel California-ness of some of their hits is so big that there's no way that band's going to be swallowed. It was a strange, but again, if you're experiencing in that time, you don't know how history is going to play out. You don't know that the Beatles are going to go
exactly
on forever.
That's exactly it. And he does talk about that. He does talk about how, and yes, to me, it was surprising too, Christian, to read that and to think or to know that he thought that.
Yeah.
But with that said, you know, he does also talk about how, and I understood it in the context of what he shares. You know, he talks about how at one point they get they're honored at the Grammys, right? And he says, you know, that was something that bands like ours didn't get. Grammys then were going to the Frank Sinatras, those were the people that were getting Grammys. And so I think that if you understand that from that point of view, then it's understandable as to why he would have thought that their music may not have had the kind of legacy that it did.
Yeah.
And how could it,
it seems like what?
From our point of view, but when we came to be and when we came to understand at that point, think about all the years that had already passed, and that's the legacy that ends up happening with music, right? It's, you don't know in the moment who's going to stick around and who's going to be amazing and who's not. It's decades later, who's still around and who still kind of has that, that power.
Sure.
His music still has that power. And that's the case with the Doors. I mean, look, some of their songs are just
amazing. Riders on the Storm. I mean, that's drama.
I mean, come on. I mean, you know, even things like Soul Kitchen. That is one of my favorite Doors songs. Yeah. It's just got such a cool, sexy, psychedelics. Like, it's just, I mean, there's just, they have such great songs. Yeah. And so of course they've been etched onto the musical history and to musical history, and they will always be a band that everyone knows.
Yeah, for sure.
Or maybe not. Or I wonder if, I often wonder if younger people, and I'm sure that there are some, but I'm always surprised when, sometimes when I'm talking to people who are much younger than I am in their 20s, and I'll mention something and they look at me with confusion. And so I wonder but I imagine that for a certain niche or a certain group of young people, they would know who the Doors are.
Yeah. I'm sure it'll go on like it or not, it's cemented for better and worse, the imagery of who this band was. It's just been enmeshed. So for sure. There's one other story. I thought it spoke well of Robbie. He's in a terrible car accident and one of his passengers he's driving at the wheel. I don't remember if he falls asleep or I didn't really put a whole lot of blame on the guy. It just felt like the way that these people were living in the 60s was metaphorically, nobody wore a seatbelt. You know, so
right.
It happens to be the one driving when there's an accident, the van flips over, he thinks he's dead and he's knocked unconscious. He wakes up and the passenger in the back seat who hadn't, of course, wouldn't wear any seatbelt. She's ultimately paralyzed from the waist down. Mm-hmm. He didn't have to tell us that story. And he just talks about the guilt, of course. And he tells us I believed him that he just spends tons of money for the rest of this person's life, trying to do everything he can to make her life better. I was taken with that story and how just casually in this story of the Doors and rock and roll, here's this human being that will never get to walk again. And he just has a black eye and he's on stage the next night.
Yes.
And that was something very jarring in real life about that story. And here's Jim Morrison. What a dick. He just drinks himself to death. That's, I tell you, he comes across as very unlikable to me. His choice, he's so selfish, such a selfish person.
Well, he talks about, you know, how he's constantly getting naked and jumping off of balconies or trying to jump off of balconies and doing very risky things and all of this. And I don't know what demons Jim Morrison was fighting. You know, there's been so much told about his upbringing and his father and, you know, his mother and all of these sorts of things. I mean, he's the only one that ever truly knew, I imagine, what those demons were. But it sounds like there was just his alcohol was such a way to suppress all of that in some way.
It seemed like it was designed to activate it. Like he was fine until he decides every night to go on this bender.
But I think, I wonder if, you know, we've talked about this before. I wonder if this was just part of the persona that he felt he had to adopt because he was a rock star, or how genuine that is, or if that's just the persona that comes with being a rock star and that's what leads. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like which came first, right? It's almost one of those things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, based on what Robbie says about him, you know, he sounds like he was likable when he was sober, but those times were so rare and few in between that the only picture that you get of him is when he's either totally high or totally drunk. There's never anything in between, or acting erratic or losing his temper, or, sleeping with tons of women. I mean, those are the only things that you get. I don't know. It was interesting.
I know you don't like this kind of stuff, Martha, but I got to tell, I want to increase our number of listeners real quick with the salacious anecdote. So cover your ears.
Oh, okay. Please.
I know you don't like it. I'll have to tell our listeners.
I am a grown woman.
The nickname, something I did learn about Jim Morrison through Robbie Krieger, is it his...
Oh, I know what you're going
to
talk about.
See, I can listen to I can hear in your voice. You're like already upset. I can hear it.
I'm not
like,
upset. I'm not upset. So
that's why
upset.
I said close your ears.
It doesn't bother me. It does. I am a grown woman.
I would ask our listeners who just heard Martha go, I know what you're going to talk about. Write in and tell me if I'm wrong. That's his nickname. And I'll let our listeners figure out why it may have been what it is. Are you ready, Martha?
I can say it if you want me to.
You say it. You say it.
I won't say it. You say it.
See?
Now you say it.
Okay, here we go. Elephant Dick.
Yeah, that was his nickname.
Look at that. You're just like so, just like, you can't be bothered. You can't handle it, hate it.
I can handle it.
Trust me, you don't know what it's like to listen to your voice go change. Yeah, I can handle it. What are you talking about? We're going to be listening to this recording in the courtroom.
Oh my goodness, you're so silly. You're ridiculous. But yes, that is his nickname, and I guess that explains why so many women were...
Ooh, Martha coming out with a little of her own sauce there. Yeah, he could open up lots of doors. Let's put it that way.
That explains. I'm sure word got around, and that's why so many women were willing to throw themselves at him. Oh my goodness.
That's never a nickname that's been given to me, but I'm not dead yet.
Oh my God, Christian. You're just making this worse.
See? What do you mean worse? I didn't think it was bad.
This is all just so uncomfortable. I don't want to talk about it.
Exactly. Thank you for acknowledging it. That's fine. It's fine. I just had to let her. It is, like it or not, as uncomfortable as it makes you, it is another nugget. It is another ball, if you will, of rock and roll knowledge. I didn't know that. Did you?
Of course not. How would I have known? But, you know, Robbie apparently got a sneak peek a couple of times.
I bet
times
Robbie has pictures of it. He hasn't lost. I bet he hasn't lost those things. The book of poems, no problem. But the photographs of elephant dick, you know.
Oh, my God, Christian. Oh, my God, Christian. You're killing me right now with this.
Well, that's Robbie. That's what he did educate us.
The best biography of Jim Morrison you'll ever read.
No doubt.
Go read it, everyone. Yeah. Go read it, ladies and gentlemen.
And then for the parts you need to know more about, go read John Densmore's. Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, man. Too funny.
I'm sorry. No, I'm just... Oh, my God. Sorry, Christian.
You know what? It's just, no, if you meet Robbie Krieger, you got to tell him, I loved your book on Jim Morrison. It was so good. It really lit my fire.
I'm sorry.
You should write one about yourself one day.
It's like, thanks for giving. It's like, thanks for giving us insight about elephant dick. Yeah.
Do you have a photo book of elephant dick? I bet his screenshot on his phone is just a picture of elephant dick. You go, yeah, it's right here.
Okay, enough. Enough about elephant dick. Oh my God, I can't. I read that, Christian, I started laughing. I've got to tell you, I was like, wow, this is a biography I've never thought I'd read.
Yeah. Thank you, Robbie.
Wow, ooh. Robbie, you really put a lot of insight.
Thank you for learning the guitar insight so I can learn about Jim Morrison's penis. He's practicing for hours and hours on the guitar just so we could learn that nugget.
The flamenco guitar all those years.
And Ray Manzarek, hours and hours of scales every day just so we could learn about elephant dick. Take that lesson to heart, kids, as you practice your scales. You don't know what's on the other side.
Okay. Oh, my God. I'm just dying. My stomach's hurting. Oh, my God. But that's what we learned.
Yeah.
We learned a lot about Jim in this book.
We did.
I'll say that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robbie. I don't know much about you, but I sure learned a lot about Jim.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I'm going to stop there, Martha.
Yes.
Thank you, Robbie. I liked it. I would recommend it, actually. There's still a couple portions that we left out regarding his brother. I thought was poignant. His father, I thought.
Oh, right.
I can see how maybe it felt like an afterthought and he squeezed it in. It didn't feel that way for me, but I liked it overall. I gave it a thumbs up. Martha says,
I liked it as a biography of Jim Morrison and a biography of the Doors.
Yeah. As a biography of anything else.
But Robbie Krieger's memoir. And, you know, before we end this episode, I do want to say that, you know, one of our friends whose book we read not that long ago, Christian, Mr. Will Sargent, you know, Echo and the Bunnymen have covered some
That's right.
Songs.
It's fitting that we did what we did.
Yes, they covered, as I think many people who listen to our podcast may be familiar with.
Yes,
People Are Strange, which is a great cover.
I didn't like it,
but I think it's great. But there's, I think that after you finish listening to us, look for the cover of Soul Kitchen.
Okay,
it is absolutely amazing. I encourage all of you listening to us to listen to it after this episode ends. It's a remarkable cover. It's I mean, it. I think this is going to sound a little blasphemous, but in some ways, I think it's even better than the original.
Yeah, it's blasphemy.
It's a fantastic cover, though. It really is. It's very, very sexy. It's very, it just has a really great vibe. And whether you're a Doors fan or not, I think you should check it out.
Okay. Well, on that note, it was a fun episode for sure.
It was.
Yeah. And so thank you, Jim, for providing comic relief.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, speaking for myself, it's been a delight to be here. And if you're listening, we thank you for that. And we're going to keep reading.
Yes. Thank you for listening to everyone. We know a lot of you are listening because we're seeing, or I'm looking at the stats, and we have lots of you. So thank you so much from wherever you're listening in the world. We really appreciate it.
On that note, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Goodbye.